Welcome everyone to another episode of That Record Got Me. Hi, I'm your host, Rob Elba. Thank you all for stopping by. My guest today is, full disclosure, someone I've known for over 40 years. We both played in bands in South Florida in the early 80s. He was in a band called The Sleep of Reason. Later on, he was in Black Tape for a Blue Girl. He was in Halo. He was in El Duende. And then he took a break for like 20 years. But he is back. And he's got a brand new solo album out now called Songs for the Fallen Mountain King. My guest name is Oscar Herrera, and the record he brought is Vienna by Ultravox. So it was a lot of fun, as always, talking to Oscar. It's always fun talking to someone that I've known a really long time, you know, off and on. It's not like we palled around for 40 years, but, you know, we knew each other back in the day, and then we reconnected at various times, and he's a great guy. And his new album is great, and it was a lot of fun talking to him. So here is my conversation with Oscar Herrera.
But how's everything going?
Good. I'm actually pretty soon going to be launching a Kickstarter for my album.
Oh, okay. Nice, nice. Yes, to put it out in vinyl, to do like a vinyl release.
Yeah, yeah. And all sorts of levels and tiers and everything. At the highest tier, you get the original illustrations I did and the crown that I wore on the cover. And
nice.
Real cheesy, you know?
All right. Well, but before we get to the cheesy album you picked, which is not really cheesy. All right. But let's talk a little bit about Songs for the Fallen Mountain King. So, Oscar, I realize even though you were making music for like 40, you've been making music for 40 years, this is your first solo release, right?
I wasn't exactly making music for 40 years. I was making it for 20, and then I took a hiatus of 20 years.
All right. Yeah, that's right.
It was 40
years ago, but you did have a hiatus. That's right.
Yeah, so this is my first solo album.
Soon as some of us can still remember the year in which Father Whiskey died, under the heel of one who was astounded when he took a bar mad for his bride. Was one which we shuddered.
And it kind of brushes up on it's all songs from the past, some that I did with some of my bands and some that I did with my bands that had never been recorded.
Right. Yeah, I was reading a little. I saw some stuff you had started the music. You did like maybe a version of something with Black Tape for a Blue Girl or something maybe that came from Sleep of Reason. So you drew from all different things, but just to make this new project, which is not really new, but I guess it's new.
Yeah. Well, yes. The presentation.
The presentation.
And the way that nowadays you can do stuff digitally and have musicians from Argentina send you their music and, you know, from Colombia. I mean, that's it's cool. And that's what I actually did. I had musicians from other countries send their parts.
Yeah, isn't that great? You did it. And yeah, and it's just like hiring someone to like hang pictures on your wall, but you could do it virtually, hire someone to play on your record. Isn't that it's amazing?
I hired this guy from Colombia to play flamenco guitar on one of the songs, and it was like $60 for the song and a video of him playing. It's like, wow.
That's great. But you know, but what's gonna happen AI when AI replace all that, when they're just gonna have AI do all that?
I don't know. I was actually just reading an article, I think it was in Rolling Stone, about AI and how you could say, write me a Memphis blues song with such and such a lyric. And then the thing comes back with a voice and everything. It's like, wow, that's scary.
I was with some people last night and someone did that. We were putting out stupid things, you know, like things like that. And then, yeah, in like 5 minutes it was a song like that. And I don't know. It's interesting, but to me it's bad. As an old guy, I'm just saying this is bad and I'm glad I'm going to be dead in like 20 years. I won't have to see what this will have wrought.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people are becoming famous now with, you know, a 1 minute Twitter song. Not Twitter. What's the other one?
TikTok.
TikTok, that one. See, that's how old I am. I knew it was with a T, but
Yeah, there Twitter, is no Twitter anymore.
It's X now. Okay. It's X. Yeah. Yeah, I can't keep right. it.
Well, let's not talk. We're not going to talk about any of that. We're going back to the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
When music was music.
When music was real and made by synthesizers, which is what we're going to talk about.
Exactly. That's so
programmed drum beats. Yes.
Right. That's so funny.
Real music.
All right. Well, first of all, Ultravox, it's funny because you had... when you had told me we were going to do Vienna by Ultravox, and this was great. I mean, I was excited because I got this album when it came out, and I remember I really liked it, even though I was already into like punk and like that. But I was into all kinds of music, and I really liked this. But I didn't even realize you like asked me if I was team Fox or team Ear. And Oscar, I'm going to be totally honest with you. As much as I love this album, and I think I got their next album after that, and I like them. Later on, when I saw there was a band, you know, from the 70s, Ultravox with a exclamation point. Yeah. I thought it was a different band.
No, that was them. That was the name of the band, the first album with the exclamation point.
Because I listened to some of it, and I said, oh, that's not the same Ultravox, because obviously a different singer was before Midyear. So originally it was Tiger Lily, right? A band called Tiger Lily.
Tiger Lily, right. And I was actually, I had a friend over earlier today, and we talked about this. I said I was going to be doing this thing, and he knew about Ultravox with John Fox. And he said, Ultravox came to play at the Agora Ballroom in 1980, touring for Vienna. Like... John Fox had just left, and I said, so which camp were you on? Oh, I was definitely Fox, and we were all there, you know, just standing there at the stage. It's like, you know, what's this guy gonna do? This
really
your guy. And then once it starts, like, it's not too bad, actually. You know, it's
actually pretty good.
Yeah, but it's too. And then we were talking about what other bands are there where the singer change the singer and the sound changes completely.
Yes, I was thinking that too. Did you come up with anyone?
Well, we had Van Halen with three different singers.
Okay, and yeah, that's true.
I don't know about you, but I'm still Roth Camp on that one.
Of course, yeah, I am too.
And then we had Queen touring with Paul Rodgers, which I never heard, but I kind of...
But that's like already... Those are both bands that were like far into careers and were already huge
bands and done it.
But this was kind of like a band that, you know, they were kind of a big deal. They were Island Records and... They had a big time producer and everything, but in listening to it, you could tell they were more like, I guess you could say glam, more maybe in the camp of like Roxy Music or Bowie, like early Bowie, things like that.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, and they were edgier, and John Fox's style of singing, which I later on went back and listened to those albums, and I actually do love them.
I like his
solo stuff too, but his singing style was very, very different. It was more speaking, he had like a different inflection than Midyear, and Midyear gave him his presence, gave them their first big hit.
Yeah,
once that album. So.
Yeah, it did. And this album, there's just no denying Midyear has this voice. I mean, his voice is such a big part of it. He's got this just like this crystal clear singing style. That just sort of cuts through.
He's one of my favorite, and he. He doesn't have a typical 80s voice. A lot of 80s voices, I call it having a potato in the throat, the way they sound. Like The Cure, the ultimate example. And the guy from Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark, they had kind of like very 80s sound.
Right.
And I actually saw Midyear play down here in 2018 at the Culture Room. It was a tour he opened for Paul Young.
Oh, wow.
And he did, you know, he did mostly Ultravox stuff and some of his solo stuff, and the guy sounds exactly the same.
That's great.
So yeah, it sounds exactly the same. Yeah, it's a very passionate voice, which I think was a good blend with those electronics that have this very passionate voice going on at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And also he's a really good musician, really great guitar player.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, the one thing I realized, you know, in going back to this record and listening to it, I go, man, there is not a lot of guitars on this album. I mean, when they do come in, they're great and they stand out. Yeah. But, you know, yeah. This is a very synth heavy record, and it's so but you know, it's great. It came out in 1980.
Yeah. And I know we're not going to be on YouTube or anything, but
no, we're not.
I had to bring this out. This is the band he was in, his first band, Slick. It was a boy band.
Oh, that's shit. Are you serious? Wait, let me see.
That's him.
Hold it up. That's, I'm going to take a picture of you holding that.
That's L-I-K. That's him right here.
Oh, my God. Look at that.
So this was 1976, 4 years before Vienna.
Oh, all right.
Look at him there. And they're all, these British guys, are all wearing baseball uniforms, like, you know,
that's
American
crazy.
Baseball.
What year is this?
1976. They put out two albums. They're songwriters. It was a songwriting team that wrote for the Bay City Rollers. Boy band, and the reason that he is Mitch is because there was another Jim in the band, so they just put his name backwards.
Oh, okay.
He became Mitch.
Oh, wow, I did not know any of this.
And then after that, it was the Rich Kids with Glenn Matlock, who was the original.
Right,
bass
right. Player. He was in the Rich Kids, and then Visage, which I'm gonna assume you were a fan of that band, or you were a fan of Visage and Steve Strange.
Yeah, Visage's debut album, and Vienna came out the same year, 1980. So at that point, he was in Visage, he was in Ultravox, and he was guitarist for Thin Lizzy.
I saw that too, which is crazy, yeah. Right?
And he co-wrote some songs for Phil Lena.
I used to be a dreamer, but I realized that it's not my style at all. In fact, it becomes clearer that a dreamer doesn't stand a chance at all.
Yeah, so just like a all-around really, really great musician.
One other thing which I didn't know is that he was approached to be lead singer for the Sex Pistols.
Oh, that I did not know.
Yeah, and he didn't agree with Malcolm McLaren's direction, which he has since, you know, said, yeah, and I was wrong about that.
He was wrong, but that would not have worked. That would not have been a good fit.
No, it wasn't.
I'm going to vote no. That's a hard no.
Yeah.
All right, so obviously in you, especially Sleep of Reason, when me and Oscar first met, I knew Oscar first from Sleep of Reason, and obviously I could tell this is a band, this is someone that you would be into, and this is music you're into, because you were, which ties into your new record now, very theatrical. I mean, you guys, Sleep of Reason, it was great then, because no matter who you were playing with, you guys were you. You didn't try to be different. You didn't try to fit in with the punks or fit in with that. You guys were you.
And the funny thing with the Sleep of Reason is that when we first started out, our detractors called us, oh yeah, they're one of those synth pop bands, and we didn't have a single synthesizer in the band.
No, you weren't.
Bass guitar and drums, and somehow we became a synth pop band, maybe because of a European flavor, I don't know what
well,
it was.
Well, you got, it was the same thing, Bauhaus always was the same way, because Bauhaus were basically, you know, they were just a, you know, a rock band, had the guitar, but the way they presented themselves and the effects they put on the guitars, it made it seem like electronic-y or things like that or something different, but no, they were just like a different flavor of a rock band.
Yeah. Bass guitar and drums, they were
about
the same lineup as The Who and as Rush.
Right, exactly. yeah, which is cool.
And now that you mentioned Bauhaus, that's how I discovered Ultravox, because I was at a phase during that time where I would buy records without knowing absolutely nothing about the record, just based on the cover. So that's how I got into Bauhaus. That's how I got into
Great
Division. And that's how I got into Ultravox, not knowing that there was actually a singer before this guy.
Oh, okay. All right. So that's what I was going to ask you. But I kind of figured that it would be, this was your first... Yeah. Like me. Like, yeah. And I honestly, I don't remember why. It could have been the same thing, because I would do that too. Obviously, we would have to buy records sometimes by someone telling us about it or just liking the cover, because there was no way for us to find out what it sounded like otherwise.
And to listen to it on Spotify or anything. It was just throw it.
No YouTube, kids.
And I would be like, oh, well, thank God I like this, because I just spent, you know, my $6 on this record.
Exactly. And there was, I mean, I'm sure.
I hard earned $6.
Yeah, I'm sure with you, there was with me, there would be times you'd buy something and then you would be disappointed. Like, it did not sound like the cover made you think it would sound.
The cover was so promising. This really sucks.
Yeah. So, you know.
Oh, and then the other thing is this. I think we had talked about this, is that this is our version of Ultravox, which was the American release. Because the song order on the first side is different than the British.
Totally different. And it's funny. I really wanted to talk to you about that, because it's really, I always think that's a funny thing that they would do that a lot. They would get these bands, and I guess they would be, for one reason or another, which I could see why they changed the order. And I guess I could see, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, now, obviously, this is the one that I listen to a ton of times, and I'm used to you, so I'm used to it.
Right.
But in listening to the European order, that makes it, I could see that. I said, oh, that's pretty good too, because, but we could talk about that when we go through the songs, because it really.
This song order is the record that got me high, so we have to go with this one.
We have American. Yeah. No, I get it.
It starts off with a bang,
and you could see why the North American release chose this as the first song, because the European one has the moody instrumental that is the close of side one.
So the U.S. offices of Chrysalis probably said, no, we need to open with a single.
Right. And that's basically what they did. They opened it with the first single. It's got a killer synth solo in it, which is awesome, right?
Speaking of synth solos, we need to shout out Billy Curry. He was the master of the pitch wheel.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yes. I mean, and if you see the videos, they're like leaning into that pitch wheel.
I know, it's great.
It's like, wheel.
It's the whammy bar of the keyboard player.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, he was, I think he's like VIP of the band. Plus he played viola. Plus he played violin.
Yes. Yeah. We're going to talk about all that, but let's listen to the opening track, Sleepwalk.
That is proof right there that a synth band can rock.
Yeah, it's true, and it really is, because I'm listening to it and there's no guitars, there's zero guitars, but a lot at that time there were a lot of bands and bands that I like I liked OMD and I like that, but some of it would be kind of toothless, you know, seem kind of toothless in a way, because it just didn't rock like this. But yeah, they were really good, and I guess that's, you know, it's much to them, like the rhythm section, the drummer, bass player, and the production also. But yeah, this shit rocks without the guitars.
And at this point, Warren Kahn, the drummer, wrote lyrics for like 3/4 of the album.
Oh, right.
So I had never really paid attention to the lyrics, because the album didn't come with lyrics, and the lyrics are pretty much like images and kind of feelings and stuff, but they're not really like detailed about any specific
thing.
They're not, really.
Right.
They're not, they're just
true.
Images. Oh man, Sleepwalk, that sounds cool. Yeah.
Exactly.
And the video for this, the official video for this, is them performing at Top of the Pops, and already Midger is establishing himself. like this 1940s film star. He's got the swagger and he's got the little mustache
Yes,
and he's got
yes, right,
a high
right,
loop
right.
like this, and which they went on to do in their videos. They had like that. That was the look that they captured with their videos and this 1940s film noir kind of thing.
Right, right. Yeah, but it all still kind of rocks more than you would think just looking at them. You know, if you look at a picture of them, you would assume one thing. And yeah, they definitely leaned into that for the North American release because they did the second song, the next single, they came out, which is also you know, a bit of a rocker, a bit of a banger. So let's do a little bit of Passing Strange.
We're too vain to dance in the dark, sing in the rain. Time on our hands, hope in our hearts. We were talking, was it strange? Moments come across and
there's some great sounds going on. That guitar, I love that guitar part with the synth is doubling up, you know, what the guitar is playing, and that bass sound is just is great.
Which we have to mention that he just passed away.
He did. Chris Cross. That's right. Yeah.
I think at the end of March. Yeah.
Yep. And so I guess a lot of credit we also got to give. We didn't mention the producer yet, right? Connie Plank.
Connie Plank. Yep. He actually worked on the third Ultravox album with John Fox. His studio was in Germany.
Oh, so, right, right. Okay. And yeah, and he's known, I mean, he was involved in releases by Neu and Kraftwerk. And, you know, someone like that, you might assume wouldn't be making music this sound, this like sort of heavy and sort of like, I don't know. I'm assuming, I really don't know that much. Did they get played on the radio? I'm assuming in Europe they did.
In Europe they got played a lot. I mean, they had did. Hits. Down here, of course. I mean, the United States. No, at all.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But it does, because when you listen to this stuff, you'd say, oh, okay, this, I mean, it just sounds great. And it sounds like something that you could definitely hear being played on the radio, but I guess more so.
Now, at the time that this was coming out, my wife and I, we were dating, and there was a club down here called Fire and Ice in Miami.
Yep.
And they had a weekly Friday thing, which was called Changes. And that was a New Romantic night. So it was Spandau Ballet, Ultravox, Bowie, stuff like that. And there, I mean, they played this stuff a lot. So the minute, you know, the minute they would hit, you know, Sleepwalk on the floor, everybody would be out there doing their sleepwalk, you know, looking right. All, you know, all plastic and important. And, you know, get up and everything, you know, it was just like this very, very cool scene. And Ultravox are definitely part of that. And they were on what I would call not the pirate end of it, because that would have been Adam Ann and, you know, like the flouncy clothes and a
right.
Like they were the slick European, German film.
Yeah,
look,
the slick back hair, the little,
right.
Mini, yeah.
Right.
As a Jew, that whole look makes me nervous, a little nervous, but you know. That's,
don't think of it that way. Think of it as New York, 1940.
No. I know. It's just, I'm just being honest. It makes me a little
And now
nervous.
this is the song, too, that because of the lyrics and the title, these passing strangers, moments caught inside an empty room, you're like, okay, what is all this about?
Right.
Really, might not be about anything, but it just puts out these images and leaves it open to interpretation, and it's good for the imagery. In the video, it's this black and white film, and it's this young couple, and they seem to be being pursued by Ultravox for some reason. I mean, Ultravox is there singing about them, and they're all very dressed up. The guy's in a tuxedo, and then at the end, they're running down this post-apocalyptic London with bombs, and then the bombs are in color, but they're in black and white.
Oh, right. Yeah, great. I remember the video, seeing the videos of them, and even back then, they were definitely a step above a lot of other bands, you know, types of videos. They were definitely going for the little mini film, you know.
The thing was, when MTV first started, the only people who had videos were the English bands.
Right.
So when we started watching MTV, it was again Spandau Ballet, Ultravox, Adam and the Ants, and they all had this sort of film quality that they were like mini movies.
Yep.
And they were just breathtaking how well made they were, and they still hold up.
Yeah, they do, for sure. And all right, so finally the third track, we finally get some guitar, some crunchy guitars in there.
If you're very waiting, crunch.
Yeah, New Europeans finally delivers on that. Let's listen to a little bit of New Europeans.
Hats off to Warren Conn, the drummer. I mean, he rocks, man. He just keeps that. It's always steady, always. I mean, it's just what keeps it moving. And it's funny because towards the end, he wanted to go more into programming stuff.
Right. Yeah.
He's such a great drummer.
I know. Well, yeah, that's, but you know what? The great drummer is the same thing with Stephen Morris, New Order later. I mean, he was fine.
Yeah.
He was fine with doing the programming and doing that too, even though he's like such a great drummer too. But yeah, that's cool though. I mean, that's good in a way that they were willing, you know, some drummers would not be down with that at all, you know?
And so this song is almost, I don't know if it's an anthem to the New Romantics or because he's talking about New Europeans. It's like a photograph of Lovers Lost pressed in magazines, her eyes belong to a thousand girls. She's a wife who's never seen. Their educated son has left in search of borrowed dreams. His television's in his bed. He's frozen to the screen. Sounds like it's about something, but then really, what does all that mean?
Yeah, no, you're right. They're more the lyrics. And looking at them now, which yeah, I'll be honest, I did pay attention to a lot of the lyrics then, but this album, I didn't. The same thing, like you said, it didn't come with lyrics. And I just, you know, it all sounds good and it sounds very mysterious. They're very good. They paint, you know, in a quiet street, washed by the rain, you know, the room within the home. They're like painting pictures and setting a mood, but they're not really filling it in that much. There's not really much narrative going on.
Yeah, but I mean, that's part of the allure.
Yeah. No, that's fine. I have no problem with that. And I think it all fits. It all fits in with the whole, you know, the whole album, the presentation of it, the cover, and just how it sounds. Yeah, it's cool. And I definitely, I will tell you, we'll get into it, the songs that I would play. But I was, like I said, I was into all different music, but a lot of my friends, I would try and turn them onto this, and they were just not having it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, not everyone's as open-minded as me and you, Oscar.
No, you know, at this point, I had met my wife and we had just been dating for about a year. So a lot of this stuff was both of us discovering at the same time. So it was, we both, from the moment we heard Vienna, the album, it was like we were both totally into it.
Yeah.
And then Need and the following album, which is a great album too. So we were discovering these things at the same time together. And I mean, really, at that point, it was really just her and me. So she was okay. She was a cool listening buddy when it came to listen to this.
Yeah, that's so funny you say that because I was actually, we were driving last night. I was driving with my wife, which me and Oscar, by the way, have both been married longer than most people have a right to be married.
Maybe American longer than the people, you know, the age of the people listening to this.
Exactly. And the same thing with my wife. I said, oh, I got to listen to, I'm listening to this because I'm going to be talking about it tomorrow and I'm playing. And she's going, oh my God, this brings me back, you know, to when we were first dating and everything.
Yeah.
Yep. So same thing.
Yeah, but in 1980, you were a teenager. I wasn't.
I'm sorry?
In 1980, you were a teenager.
I was
right?
a teenager. That's true. I graduated high school in 81, but we were already together. We've been together since high school.
So
we
wow. Already.
Yeah.
Kudos to you. Actually, in 1980, I was at the end of my teenage years. I was 19. So
okay. We're close. Yeah. All right. So this next one, Private Lives, it has that really nice piano intro that kind of tricks you, and then it kicks into another like synth heavy rocker. It's great though. I really like it.
Yeah. Wait. I don't know. You probably won't get to the point. That point where the guitar builds up, and then is there a way that you can just?
I will. I'll put it in there. I don't. I forget how long the clip goes, but we'll play it, and then if not, I'll put it in after.
Yeah, that is the ultimate moment in this song.
It is, but I had to play the beginning because I just love how the beginning comes in. But yeah. Let's just do a little bit of Private Life. So the clip does not come up to that bridge part, but I'll play it under. I'll definitely play it under because it is. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's that pitch wheel. I mean, that guy is he's like lead guitar on a pitch wheel.
Yeah. Which is great, and it's funny. I'm a sucker for stuff like that, and yeah, like you said, we weren't things like that weren't at our disposal when we were first, you know, had bands and everything. You know, we just didn't. I didn't know anyone that had a keyboard like that at some size.
Yeah, and I think it's him playing the piano at the intro, too.
Yeah, really.
That's one of the cool things about this band is that they had a sort of classical element to them.
I mean, and they definitely leaned, they definitely leaned into that and made use of that. And, you know, it was probably, you know, it probably helped them maybe in Europe and maybe hurt them here, I would say.
Yeah.
And it's funny, yeah. So as we said, this now we get to the last song on side one, and they totally flipped around the order because this is a really cool instrumental, Astrodyne. But I could see the label going, "Oh, the U.S. Americans aren't going to, you know, put up with this whole really long instrumental right at the beginning of the album." You know,
when they reunited, I think it was 2000. Well, they reunited in 2008, and they did a big tour. I actually have it. It's called the Return to Eden tour.
Okay.
And they sounded fantastic, but they would open with this.
Oh, nice.
And just from the very beginning, you have that ticking thing that goes throughout the whole thing.
It's great. I mean, it's a really great opener. It is great as an opener.
It's just very powerful.
I totally understand why they felt the need to flip and everything. But, you know, I would have been fine. I'm fine either way.
Was it Astrodyne or Astrodyne? I've never heard anybody pronounce it. So
I'm notorious for mispronouncing things, but
I'll go with Astrodyne.
Astrodyne, I will go with that. So we're probably both wrong. But anyway, let's just do a little bit of Astrodyne.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is it's great. It's a really good instrumental. I like instrumentals where you feel where you don't really miss someone singing, because it definitely takes you on this little journey, you know.
And later on Billy Currie comes in with a violin solo, which is just beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's great. And once again, Warren Cann, the drummer, like just adds, you know, when he kicks in, he just like drives. He drives these songs. All right, Mr. X, in a way, I felt like this was kind of a throwback to the Ultravox with an exclamation point.
Of yore, yes.
Yeah, very, because actually
very craft-worky.
Yeah, well, and I was listening to that first I think it was the first album, the one that's just called Ultravox with the exclamation point. There's a song in it called My Sex, which is kind of similar and kind of cool as well. But yeah, so I guess the drummer Warren Cann takes over the lead vocals on this one, right?
Yeah, and well, he doesn't actually sing, he speaks it. And he sounds very American. He doesn't have an accent. He's actually Canadian, he's not English.
But, okay, that makes sense.
That's the accent.
Yeah, makes
and
sense.
And again, this is totally film noir. I can see the bridge, I can see his dark strangers, black and white.
Yeah.
It's very third man, you know, like the movie, you know, is like what, you know, some mysterious stuff going on.
For sure. And you could totally hear the influence of a Kraftwerk, someone like Kraftwerk on this as well.
Yeah.
For sure. All right. Listen to Mr. X. Mysterious, right?
Very mysterious. In that concert video I told you about where they reunite, they performed this live. Him doing this behind the drums is very cool.
Oh, nice. That's great. Yeah. And yeah, I like that. I like from the 80s because now they can make these drum machines. They can make them sound exactly like drums. But I like when they use it and you could hear that. It's got that, like, you know, that electronic, you know, obviously snare sound. That's not obviously a live snare, but that kind of adds to everything, I feel like, at this point for something like this.
Yeah,
that sound is great. And then this next one, Western Promise, you got sequencers going on. Nice use of a sequencer, which is very futuristic. At the time, that was all very futuristic. You know, we're all used to hearing sequencers now.
Yeah, and he's singing about all this talk about mystical East and, you know, the promise that we make to you. I don't know if he's trying to do, you know, relations between the East and the West.
Right. But that's all, yeah, the mystical, that's all that shit's right up your alley, though, right, Oscar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is now, but at this time you were listening what like other type of music, or what other bands were you listening to at this time though?
Well, like I said, this was the time that I was discovering bands simply by buying the record, so I would have been Closer by Joy Division, it would have been Bauhaus in the Flat Field, the first album,
right?
Bowie, of course, Bowie's always there, and then the punky stuff. I mean, I was listening to the Ramones and the Clash, and
yeah, all different stuff. I know that was the thing then. It wasn't just you didn't just stay. I mean, I guess some people did just stay in their own very specific lane camp, but most people, a lot of people, especially people like us, didn't, right? I mean, we were just anything good, right?
But as far as the style and the music that this band was doing, I really loved it. I could relate to it. And I think you could say that they maybe had borrowed from Bowie's Thin White Duke era, you know, where it was very stylized and very slick.
Right.
The suits and the shirts and the vests and, you know, Very, very stylized. And that club that I was telling you about, Changes, there was this two different guys who would come dressed Bowie-esque, but one of them was more Ziggy and the other one was right. more thin.
Oh yeah, you could be there yeah, could be yeah. five different there could have been five different Bowies.
So we would be like, was it Bowie one or Bowie two? Oh no, it was Bowie one. Yeah.
That's great. All right, let's do a little bit of Western Promise. Actually has this really long intro till he starts, but I'm going to bring it in a little further in the song when they start singing, because I like once it comes in, it's got this really long intro, but here's when it starts singing.
On old postcards, your childhood dreams and energies, your temples, gardens, old world charm, and ancient culture, torn and scarred. This is my Western promise. Oh, mystical East, you've lost your way. Your rising sun shall rise again. My Western world gives out her hand of victor's help to your fallen land.
So, Oscar, one thing I wanted to point out on this is, like, now on his vocals, they're using this, like, effect, this heavy effect. But I appreciate the restraint in the record, because if the whole album had been like that, all these different processing and everything, it would be too much and it would get, you know. But I like the fact that they'll bring it in on a song like this, but it's not, you know, some songs, like, especially the next song, you're just letting the voice come through without worrying about
saying,
being, yeah.
And what is that sound on this song, especially in that part, there's, like, this sort of scraping...
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming. Yeah.
I've never figured out what that is.
Yeah, I don't know. You can't tell from the liner notes. It could just be some kind of thing that they did in the synth, or they could have used something in the studio, you know, which they would do back then, which is
now,
which is cool.
when they kick into this beat, it has a very like march, like taunt, taunt.
Yeah, yeah.
Taunt, taunt, taunt. You're like, you're almost thinking like it's army coming through, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think of a German army, and again, I start getting nervous a little, but you know, that's just me. All right. So I also like how the end of this song, I guess I realized, because when me and you obviously listen to the records, and it would bleed right into the next song, into Vienna, because the single version, it's not like that. It has an actual beginning. But this was the third single, and really their breakout, right? This was their big...
This was their breakout, and I think it reached like number two or something, several charts. But it was a huge success. And a few years ago, Majur did an album called Orchestrated, where they took a bunch of Ultravox songs and solo songs with a full orchestra. And they did this one. And it just perfectly lends itself to that.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Orchestral to begin with.
I got to hear that. But there's actually a lot to talk about and unpack. Let's listen to a little bit and then we'll talk about it. Listen to a little bit of the beautiful Vienna.
dream, so mystic and soulful. A voice reaching out in a piercing cry, it stays with you until
So there's so much going on here, right? Because it's got that little drum. It's simple, but that little drum machine pattern that Warren Cann uses,
and that echo thing, that thing that's echoing, you know, that dun dun.
Yeah.
I mean, this song is, to me, it's a masterpiece. It's just the production wise, how it's just builds up, and you're just like, they're holding back and just have that one synth line going through until it builds up to the chorus and he just sings it. And John Fox could have never pulled this song off.
No, for sure. Because you got the middle part, I'll play some of it, where you got that grand piano. And then you get that viola solo in the middle of it, which is awesome. But ultimately, the star of the song is Midyear's singing.
Oh, for sure.
Right? Yeah, that's like the star of the song.
Yeah, and then the video was directed by Russell Mulcahy, who did a bunch of videos of that era, and that is its total like cinematic masterpiece. And I guess it takes place in Vienna, but there's a party of very decadent people, very rich people, but they all have like stuff going on in their faces, and then there's a baron, and there's a woman, and then there's murder that happens, and Ultravox shows up, and they take pictures of everybody, and Midyear's in the foreground, you know, narrating this whole thing. There's a horse, there's fog. It's like, let's just give this a full cinematic masterpiece look, you know. It's like,
exactly.
film. And the video really has nothing to do with what the song's about.
It's funny because the song really doesn't have much to do with the song. Because I read something. Did you read like how some of the lines came out, the words, like how they came about?
No.
Okay. According to Curry, Midge was hesitant about the overly like classical romantic feel of the orchestration. And he said, this means nothing to me. He literally said, this means nothing to me. And then Connie Plank said, well, then sing that. And that became the line, this means nothing to me.
And the thing is that the way he sings it, you know it means everything to
yeah,
him.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's it.
He's singing that, but you know he's lying through his teeth. It means everything.
And another thing that I found, I was going to talk to you about at the beginning when we were talking, but I said I'd save it. Live Aid. Do you remember when they did this at Live Aid?
I don't remember. Which is something we need to mention. Is actually he and Bob Geldof are the ones that wrote Do They Know It's Christmas, which led off to the whole Live Aid thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So they played at Live Aid in the one in England. You know, the same one Queen played. They played early in the day. And I think, they weren't obviously as big a band as some of the other bands playing, but yeah, like you said, he was with him and Bob Geldof, it wouldn't have happened without them. And there's a version, you could find it on YouTube, of them doing this at Live Aid, and it is
I'm gonna have to look for that.
It is he nails every note perfectly. It's just like unbelievable.
Was it like a massive crowd sing along with this?
They didn't. No, it was like quiet. It was like this huge crowd, everyone quiet, and him just like I said, just nailing it. And it's beautiful.
I tell you, when I saw him in 2018 here in Fort Lauderdale, he nailed everything. He played guitar the way he played. He sang the same way. Still sounds great.
All right. Well, I want to ask you a little bit about that, about singing when you're older and stuff like that. So we're going to talk, but let's talk about the last song on it first, because this was the last song. And I will tell you, Oscar, this would be the song that I would play for my more rock guitar friends to convince them that some of these new wave bands could still rock and be heavy. This was the song that I would play. So because it's just got a killer guitar in there. It's great. But let's just do a little bit of All Stood Still.
Lights went out.
The last is blue.
The clocks all stopped.
It can't be
Yeah, that guitar, and that's mid-year playing that guitar. That guitar is badass.
This was a dance floor favorite. Oh, at, Fire and Ice, I'm telling you. And then that line about, please remember me, tapes you leave behind. We wouldn't be leaving tapes nowadays. We'd be leaving some digital file or something.
Yes,
back.
Exactly.
Tapes you leave behind. It's like, what is that about? Tapes you leave behind. Will I no longer be here when I leave these tapes? Who are you going to leave them for? All very mysterious.
Right.
And this was the single. This was another single.
It was. Yeah, and it's great. Like I said, this is the song that I would try to convert people over to.
Did it work?
Sometimes it would work. They would, but sometimes they would say, oh, well, I like that song, but then that'd be it, you know? So I don't know. You know, I would always put this on if I was making a mixtape for someone, I would put this song on it, though, always.
Yeah. Good introduction, though.
I think so, for sure. All right. Yeah. So, Oscar, this is what I wanted to talk to you about. Because one thing, first of all, I'm very proud of you because me and Oscar, like, sort of reconnected. You were done with music. You had been done with music for a long time, right? You were, you know.
Totally done for like 20 years. I'm totally done.
I didn't realize it was that long. But yeah, but you retired from what you were doing and you're Restore. We should mention you got Spinelli Vintage Radios. So you restore vintage phonographs and radios, which is really cool. But all of a sudden, you do this release this Songs for the Fallen Mountain King, which is like really cool, just like a major thing that you did. So I'm very proud of you that you
thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, the month I retired, I retired at the end of April of last year, so it'll be a year. And as soon as I retired, I said, you know what I need to do? I need to get back into music. I'm going to put out an album.
Okay, but it wasn't something you necessarily had planned, that you were planning.
Not at all. And actually, I had planned it at one point back when we did the Miami Punk reunion.
Right.
Back in 2017. John Tovar, who has since passed away, we had talked about, he was doing like a legacy artist thing of local solo artists, you know, older people, and he wanted to put this out. So this album started at that point, 2017. Song order that it is now is the one I was going to do then, and then he passed away, and then the guy who was going to finance it had a heart attack and like all this strange stuff, and then I put it in the back burner. And then when I retired, I said, yeah, I'm going to try that again.
Right.
So I called up the bass player Greg Young from the Sleep of Reason, the guitarist from Halo, the drummer from El Duende. I had from three different bands of my bands, and we got it together.
Nice. Now, yeah. were you worried at any point? Because you hadn't, I mean, I'm sure you had sung somewhat. I mean, I know we did a little thing together for Richard Shelton's birthday, and you and Danielle came and you sang. So I knew you could still sing. But, you know, people's voices change and everything. But I think you sound really good on this. I mean, you sound great.
Okay.
So were you concerned? Were you worried, though?
I was initially when I started. It was basically just, you know, we were working the muscles. I mean, I did have some froggy moments, you know, but it was just basically getting back into it. Right. And the title of the album actually comes from when I did an album with Sam Rosenthal for Black Tape for Blue Girl back in 2016. My voice had gotten deeper and a little more gravelly. And my son, Adrian, who actually sings backup on this album, he says, you know, I love how your voice sounds. It sounds like the voice of some fallen mountain king.
Ah, I said, nice.
That is an album title right there. So that's where that came from.
Oh, that's great. All right, so Oscar, so the best place, I mean, we're not, you said we're doing something for the release of Songs for the Fallen Mountain King, doing the Kickstarter, but that's not up yet, right?
It's not up yet. It should be within the next week or two. Right now, if anybody wants to listen to it, it's every single platform, digital platform. If you want to help the cause and download it and, you know, and stream it, it's on Bandcamp.
It is on, yeah, go to Bandcamp. Don't go to Spotify. I'm trying to stop.
Well, Spotify, you can't really buy it. You know,
no, but
you
don't have, go to, don't even listen to it. Don't use Spotify. I'm trying to get
and, on Spotify, I would have to be listened to 3 billion times before I make $2 on it. So,
exactly.
But on Bandcamp, the money goes directly to the artist. So
and then, eventually, when the Kickstarter is, they'll see it. You'll have something on there.
Yeah.
All right. It was great having you on again. All right. Don't forget, if you want to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, it's at That Record Got Me High. On X, it's at TRGMH Podcast. You can email me at trgmh33@gmail.com. Most importantly, if you want to become a patron of the show and support us, go to patreon.com/TRGMH. Oscar, it's always a pleasure.
Same here. Thank you for having me on again.
All right. Thanks for coming on. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week. I'm Rob Elba.
Final sound, final sound, final sound.